wounded and confused, away from this world and into another. The simple assuring calm, the rightness of this place, set him off balance and made him doubt, if only for a moment, that anything could be amiss. But he knew the peace was superficial. Somewhere in the palace that bridged the river his presence had surely been missed. Somewhere in the city two men lay dead, and more with empty eyes were likely looking for him and his prize. But here, on what had been Whitbury and was now Ves Arnash, the light of the river spilling in from one side and the morning sun from the other, Red London seemed oblivious to the danger it was in. The danger he was dragging through it. A small black stone capable of creating anything and raising everything. He shuddered at the thought, and tightened his grip on Nyla's hand, only to realize it was not there. He spun, hoping to find her standing next to him, hoping they'd been pulled apart only a step or two in the course of their passage. But he was alone. The echo of Antari magic glowed faintly on the wall, marking the way he'd come with Lila. But Lila was gone, and with her, the stone. Kells slammed his hand against the wall, splitting open the cut that had just begun to close. Blood trickled down his wrist, and Kells swore and went to search for a cloth in his coat, forgetting that he'd draped it over Lila's shoulders. He was halfway through swearing again when he remembered Lila's kerchief, the one she'd given him in exchange, tucked into his back pocket. "Seems right, somehow," she'd said. "You gave me something of yours, I give you something of mine. Now we're linked." "Linked," thought Kell. His mind spun as he dragged the square of fabric free. Would it work? Not if she'd somehow been torn apart or trapped between the worlds. There were stories of non-Antari who tried to open doors and got stuck. But if she'd never come through, or if she was here somewhere, alive or dead, it might. He brought the blood-stained kerchief to the wall and pressed his hand flat against the echo of his recent mark. "Ars Enosa," he commanded the magic. "Ars Enosa de Lila Bard." Lila opened her eyes and saw red. Not a bold red, splashed like paint over the buildings, but a subtle, pervasive tint, like she was looking through a pane of coloured glass. Lila tried to blink away the colour, but it lingered. When Kell called his city Red London, she assumed he'd picked the colour for some arbitrary or at least ordinary reason. Now she could see that he meant it literally. She drew a breath and tasted flowers on the air. Lilies and marigolds and stargazers. The scent was overpowering, verging on sickly sweet, like perfume. No wonder it clung to Kell. After a few moments it calmed a little, so did the tint, as her senses adjusted to her new surroundings. But when she drew too deep a breath, it assaulted her again. Lila coughed and lay still. She was on her back in an alley in front of a rather pretty red door, painted, not tinted. A loose street stone dug into her spine through the coat. Kell's coat. It was spread beneath her on the ground, billowing out like wings. But Kell was not there. She tightened her fingers to make sure she could move them and felt the black stone nested in her palm, still humming. It worked, she thought, letting out an amazed exhale as she sat up. It had actually worked. Not perfectly. If it had worked perfectly, she and Kell would be standing in the same place. But she was here, which was to say, there, somewhere new. She'd done it. Delilah Bard had finally escaped, sailed away, not with a ship, but with a stone. As for where she was exactly, she hadn't the faintest idea. She got to her feet and realized that the red tint wasn't coming from the sky, but from the ground. The world to her right was considerably redder than the world to her left. And she realized, senses tuning, considerably louder. not just the usual noise of peddlers and carts, for the Londons seemed to have that in common, but the din of a growing crowd, all cheers and shouts and celebration. Part of her knew she should stay still and wait for Kell to find her, but the other part was already moving toward the swell of light and colour and sound. Kell had found her once, she reasoned. He could do it again. She tucked the black stone into the hidden pocket of her worn cloak. The dizziness upon letting go was brief and shallow, then scooped up Kell's coat, dusted it off and pulled it on over the top. She expected it to be bulky, if not outright unruly, but to her surprise the coat fit perfectly, its silver buttons lying smooth and even on the rich black fabric. Strange, thought Lila, shoving her hands into its pockets. Not the strangest thing by far, but still strange. She wove through the streets, which were like her London in their narrow, twisting fashion, and yet so different. Instead of rough stone and soot-stained glass, the shops were built of dark wood and smooth rock, coloured glass and shining metal. They looked strong and strangely delicate at once, and running through them all, through everything, was an energy. She could think of no other word. She walked in the direction of the crowd, marvelling at the change wrought in the world, a world whose bones were shared with hers, but whose body was a new, glorious thing. And then she turned a corner and saw the source of the commotion. Scores of people had gathered along a major road, bustling in anticipation. They had the air of commoners, and yet their dress was so much finer than Lila had ever seen on the commoners at home. Their style itself was not so foreign. The men wore elegant coats with high collars, the women waist-cinched dresses under capes. But the materials flowed on them like melted metal, and threads of gold ran through hair and hat and cuff. Lila pulled Kell's silver-buttoned coat close around her, thankful she could hide the threadbare cloak beneath. In the cracks between the jostling crowd she could make out the Red River beyond, right where the Thames should have been, its strange light washing over the banks. The Thames? A source of magic? Perhaps the greatest source in the world, not that you'd know it here, but if you could see it as it is in my London. It was indeed magnificent. And yet, Lila was drawn less to the water and more to the ships blanketing it. Vessels of all shapes and sizes, from brigs and galleys to schooners and frigates, bobbed on the red waves, their sails billowing. Dozens of emblems marked the fabric on their masts and flanks, but over them all red and gold banners had been hung. They glittered, taunting her. "Come aboard," they seemed to say. "I can be yours." Had Lila been a man of the ship's fair maidens, guiding up their skirts, she could not have wanted them more. "Hang the fine dresses," she thought. "I'll take a ship." But though the mismatched fleet was enough to draw a gasp of approval from Lila's lips, it was neither the gorgeous ships nor the impossible Red River that held the crowd's attention. A procession was marching down the avenue. Lila reached the edge of the crowd as a row of men paraded past, clothed in swaths of dark fabric that wound around their bodies as if their limbs were spools. The men held fire in their palms, and when they danced and spun, the fire arced around them, tracing their paths and lingering in the air behind them. Their lips moved as they did, the words buried under the sounds of the parade, and Lila found herself pressing forward into the crush to get a better view. Too soon the men were gone, but in their wake a line of women came into view. Dressed in flowing gowns, they executed a more fluid version of the same dance, but with water. Lila watched wide-eyed. It behaved like ribbon in their hands, twisting and curling through the air as if by magic. Of course, thought Lila, It is by magic. The water dancers gave way to earth, and then metal, and finally wind. The last made visible by coloured dust blown from palms into the air. Every dancer was dressed in their own way, but all had ribbons of red and gold tied off along their arms and legs, trailing behind them like comet tails as they moved through the city. Music rose in the dancers' wake, strong as drums but sweet as strings, drawing notes Lila had never heard from instruments she had never seen. The musicians continued on, but the music lingered in the air, hanging over the crowd like a tent ceiling, as if sound itself could be made physical. It was hypnotic. And then came the knights atop their mounts, armour shining in the sun and red cloaks billowing behind them. The horses themselves were glorious beasts, not speckled, but solid whites and greys and glossy blacks. Almost as beautiful, thought Lila, as the ships. Their eyes were like polished stones, some brown, others blue or green. Their glistening manes ran black or silver or gold, and they moved with a grace that didn't match their size or pace. The knights all held banners like jousting poles, a golden sun rising against a red sky. Just then a huddle of young boys cut in front of Lila on their way past, trailing ribbons from their arms and legs, and she hooked one around the collar. "What's all this about?" she asked the squirming child. The child's eyes went wide, and he spit out a string of words in a tongue she did not recognize. It certainly wasn't English. "Can you understand me?" she asked, drawing out the words, but the boy only shook his head, wriggled in her grip, and spat out foreign words until she let him go. Another louder cheer rippled through the gathered crowd, and she looked up to see an open carriage approaching. It was pulled by a set of white horses and flanked by an armoured guard. The carriage ran banners that were more ornate and more elaborate. Here the sun she'd seen on so many flags rose over a chalice, as if the contents of the cup were morning light. The cup itself was marked by an ornate M, all of it woven in shades of gold thread against red silk. In the carriage stood a man and a woman holding hands, crimson cloaks pouring from their shoulders and pooling on the polished carriage floor. They were tan, both of them, with sun-kissed skin and black hair that showed off the gleaming gold crowns nested there. Royalty, thought Lila. Of course. It was a different world, a different king and queen. But there was always royalty. And there between the king and queen, one boot up on the seat like a conqueror, stood a young man, a thin crown glinting in his dark tousled locks, a cloak of pure gold spilling over his broad shoulders. A prince. He raised his hand in a wave to the crowd, and they devoured the gesture. "Vales Rai!" A shout went up from the other side of the parade, quickly taken up and carried on by a dozen other voices. "Vales Rai! Vales Rai!" The prince flashed a dazzling smile, and several feet to Lila's left a young woman actually swooned. Lila scoffed at the girl's silliness, but when she turned back to the parade, she caught the prince looking at her, intensely. Lila felt her face go hot. He didn't smile, didn't wink, only held her gaze for a long, long moment, brow crinkling faintly as if he knew she didn't belong, as if he looked at her and saw something else. Lila knew she should probably bow, or at least avert her eyes, but she stared stubbornly back. And then the moment passed. The prince broke into a fresh smile and turned back toward his subjects, and the carriage continued on, leaving ribbons and dancers and excited citizens in its wake. Lila dragged herself back to her senses. She didn't realize how far she'd pressed forward with the rest of the crowd until she heard the cluster of girls chattering at her elbow.
"Where was he?"
murmured one of them. Lila started, relieved to hear someone speaking her language.
"Sarah Sinagos,"
said another, then in heavily accented English.
"You sound good."
"Rensitav,"
said the first.
"I'm practicing for tonight."
"You should as well, if you want to dance."
She rose up onto her toes to wave at the disappearing prince.
"Your partner in dance,"
said a third in broken English,
appears to be missing."
The first girl frowned.
"He is always in the procession. I do hope he is well."
"Mas avem,"
said the second, rolling her eyes.
"Elisa is in love with the black-eyed prince."
Lila frowned. "Black-eyed prince."
"You cannot deny he is dashing, in a haunted kind of way."
"Anesh, in a frightening kind of way."
"Dark, he is nothing compared to Rai."
"Excuse me,"
cut in Lila. The trio of girls twisted toward her.
"What is all this?"
she asked, waving her hand at the parade.
"What's it for?"
The one who spoke in broken English let out an amazed laugh as though Lila must be joking.
"Mas Arvin,"
said the second,
"where are you from that you do not know? It is Prince Rai's birthday, of course."
"Of course," echoed Lila.
"Your accent is remarkable,"
said the one who'd been searching for her black-eyed prince, Elisa.
"Who is your tutor?"
Now it was Lila's turn to laugh. The girls only stared at her. But then trumpets, at least they sounded roughly like trumpets, began to sound from the direction the royals and the rest of the festival had come, and the crowd, now in the procession's wake, moved toward the music, taking the cluster of girls with it. Lila stepped out of the throng and brought her hand to her pocket, checking to make sure the black rock was still there. It was. It hummed, wanting to be held. But she resisted the urge. It may be clever, but so was she. Without the procession blocking her view, Lila could fully see the glittering river on the other side of the road. It shone with an impossible red light, as if lit from beneath. A source, Kell had called the river, and Lila could see why. It vibrated with power, and the royal procession must have crossed a bridge, for now it trailed down the opposite bank to far-off chants and cheers. Lila's eyes trailed along the water until they reached a massive vaulting structure that could only be the palace. It sat not on the banks of the river like Parliament, but over the river itself, spanning the water like a bridge. It seemed carved out of glass or crystal, its joints fused with copper and stone. Lila took in the structure with hungry eyes. The palace looked like a jewel. No, a crown of jewels, better sized to a mountain than a head. The trumpets were issuing from the steps, where servants in red and gold half-cloaks were pouring out, carrying trays of food and drink for the masses. The scent on the air of strange food and drink and magic was utterly intoxicating. Lila felt her head swimming with it as she stepped into the street. The crowds were thinning, and between the emptying road and the Red River a market had blossomed like a hedge of roses. A portion of the masses had gone with the royal parade, but the rest had taken to the market, and Lila followed.
"Krysak!"
called a woman holding up fiery red gems.
"Nisalin!"
"Tisana!"
urged another with what looked like a steaming metal teapot.
"Kas Tisana!"
He waved two fingers in the air.
"Sesalin!"
Everywhere merchants announced their wares in their strange tongue. Lila tried to pick up terms here and there to pair the shouted words with the items held aloft. "Kas" seemed to mean hot, and lin, she guessed, was a kind of coin. But everything was bright and colourful and humming with power, and she could hardly focus long enough to keep track of anything. She pulled Kel's coat tighter about her shoulders and wandered the booths and stalls with hungry eyes. She had no money, but she had quick fingers. She passed a store marked Esenir, and saw within a table piled high with polished stones of every colour, not simple reds or blues, but perfect imitations of nature. Fire yellow, summer grass green, night blue. The merchant's back was to her, and she couldn't help herself. Lila reached for the nearest charm, a lovely blue-green stone the colour of the open sea. At least, the colour she imagined it must be, the colour she'd seen it painted, with small white marks like breaking waves. But when her fingers curled around it, a hot pain seared across her skin. She gasped, more from the shock of being burned than the heat itself, and pulled back sharply, hand singing. Before she could retreat, the merchant caught her by the wrist.
"Kesla!" he demanded.
When she didn't answer, couldn't answer, he started shouting faster and louder, the words blurring together in her ears.
"Unhand me!"
she demanded. The merchant's brow furrowed at the sound of her voice.
"What you think?"
he said in guttural English.
"You get free by speaking fancy?"
"I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about," snapped Lila. "Now let go."
"Speak Arnesian, speak English, doesn't matter. Still ghast, still thief."
"I am not a ghast," growled Lila.
"Viris ghast. Fool thief. Tries to steal from enchanted tent."
"I didn't know it was enchanted," countered Lila,
reaching for the dagger at her waist.
"Pilzer," growled the merchant,
and Lila had a feeling she'd just been insulted. And then the merchant raised his voice.
"Strast!"
he shouted. And Lila twisted in his grip to see armoured guards at the edge of the market.
"Strast!"
he called again, and one of the men cocked his head and turned toward them. "Shit," thought Lila, wrenching free of the merchant's grip, only to stumble back into another set of hands. They tightened on her shoulders, and she was about to draw her knife when the merchant went pale.
"Master Arvin,"
he said, hunching forward into a bow. The hands holding Lila vanished, and she spun to find Kel standing there, frowning his usual frown and staring past her at the merchant.
"What is the meaning of this?"
he asked, and Lila didn't know which surprised her more. His sudden appearance, the way he spoke to the merchant, his voice cool, dismissive, or the way the merchant looked at him, with a mixture of awe and fear. Kel's auburn hair was pushed back, his black eye on display in the red morning light.
"Arvin Varys, if I knew she was with you,"
stammered the merchant before lapsing back into Arnesian, or whatever the language was called. Lila was surprised to hear the tongue pour out of Kel's mouth in response as he tried to calm the merchant. And then she caught that word again, "ghast," on the merchant's tongue and lunged for him. Kel hauled her back.
"Enough,"
Kel snarled in her ear.
"Sola, sir,"
he said to the merchant apologetically.
"She's a foreigner. Uncivilized, but harmless."
Lila shot him a dark look.
"Anish Masvaris,"
said the merchant, bowing even lower.
"Harmful enough to steal."
With his head down, the merchant didn't see Kel look back over his shoulder at the guard weaving through the market toward them. He didn't see the way Kel stiffened, but Lila did.
"I will buy whatever she tried to take,"
said Kel hastily, digging a hand in the pocket of his coat, unconcerned by the fact Lila was still wearing it. The merchant straightened and started shaking his head.
"Arn, I cannot be taking money from you."
The guard was getting closer, and Kell clearly didn't want to be there when he arrived, because he fetched a coin from the coat and set it on the table with a snap.
"For your trouble,"
he said, turning Lila away.
"Was ihr?"
He didn't wait for the merchant's answer, only shoved Lila through the crowd away from the stall, and the guard about to reach it.
"Uncivilized,"
growled Lila as Kell clasped her shoulder and guided her out of the market.
5 minutes,
said Kell, sliding his coat from her shoulders and back onto his own, flicking up the collar.
You can't keep your hands to yourself for 5 minutes.
Tell me you haven't already gone and sold off the stone.
Lila let out an exasperated noise.
Unbelievable,
she snapped, as he led her out of the throngs and away from the river toward one of the narrower streets.
I'm so glad you're all right, Lila,
she parroted.
Thank God using the stone didn't rip you into 1,000 thieving pieces.
Kell's hand loosened on her shoulder.
I can't believe it worked.
Don't sound so excited,
shot Lila dryly. Kell came to a stop and turned her toward him.
I'm not, he said.
His blue eye looked troubled, his black unreadable.
I'm glad you're unhurt, Lila, but the doors between worlds are meant to be locked to all but Antari.
And the fact that the stone granted you passage only proves how dangerous it is.
And every moment it's here in my world, I'm terrified.
Lila found her eyes going to the ground.
Well then, she said, let's get it out of here.
A small grateful smile crossed Kell's lips, and then Lila dug the stone out of her pocket and held it up.
And Kell let out a dismayed sound and swallowed a hand with his, hiding the stone from sight.
Something flickered through his eyes when he touched her, but she didn't think it was her touch that moved him. The stone gave a strange little shudder in her hand, as if it felt Kell and wanted to be with him. Lila felt vaguely insulted.
Sankt, he swore at her. Just hold it up for all to see, why don't you?
I thought you wanted it back,
she shot back exasperated.
There's no winning with you.
Just keep it, he hissed. And for King's sake, keep it out of sight.
Lila shoved it back into her cloak and said a very many unkind things under her breath.
And on the topic of language, said Kell, you cannot speak so freely here. English is not a common tongue.
I noticed that. Thanks for the warning.
I told you the worlds would be different. But you're right. I should have warned you.
Here, English is a tongue used by the elite and those who wish to mingle with them. Your very use of it will cause you to stand out. Lila's eyes narrowed.
What would you have me do? Not speak?
The thought had crossed my mind, said Kell.
Lila scowled.
But as I doubt that's possible for you, I'd ask that you simply keep your voice down.
He smiled, and Lila smiled back, resisting the urge to break his nose.
Now that that's settled,
he turned to go.
Pilse,
she grumbled, hoping it meant something foul indeed, as she fell into step behind him. 2. Aldous Fletcher was not an honest man. He ran a pawn shop in an alley by the docks, and each day men came off the boats, some with things they wanted, others with things they wanted to be rid of. Fletcher provided for both, and for the locals, too. It was a truth widely known in the darker corners of Red London that Fletcher's shop was the place for anything you shouldn't have. Now and again, honest folk wandered in, of course, wanting to find or dispose of smoking pipes and instruments, scrying boards and runestones and candlesticks. And Fletcher didn't mind padding the shop with their wares as well, in case the Royal Guard came to inspect. But his true trade lay in risk and rarity. A smooth stone panel hung on the wall beside the counter, as big as a window but as black as pitch. On its surface, white smoke shifted and shimmered and spread itself like chalk, announcing the full itinerary of the prince's birthday celebrations. An echo of Rye's smiling face ghosted itself on the scrying board above the notice. He beamed and winked as beneath his throat the message hovered, "The King and Queen invite you to celebrate the Prince's 20th year on the palace steps following the annual parade." After a few seconds, the message and the Prince's face both dissolved, and for a moment the scrying board went dark, then came back to life and began to cycle through a handful of other announcements.
"Irasa is Firasa,"
rumbled Fletcher in his deep voice. "Coming or going?" The question was lobbed at a boy, and he was a boy, the stubble of his first beard growing in patchily, who stood considering a table of trinkets by the door. Coming meant a buyer, going meant a seller.
"Neither," murmured the boy.
Fletcher kept an eye on the youth's wandering hands, but he wasn't too worried. The shop was warded against thieving. It was a slow day, and Fletcher almost wished the boy would try. He could use a little entertainment.
"Just looking,"
he added nervously. Fletcher's shop didn't usually get lookers. People came with a purpose, and they had to make that purpose known. Whatever the boy was after, he didn't want it badly enough to say.
"You let me know," said Fletcher, "if you can't find what it is you're looking for."
The boy nodded but kept cheating glances at Fletcher, or rather at Fletcher's arms, which were resting on the counter. The air outside was heavy for a morning so late in the harvest season. One might have thought that, given his clientele, the shop would run thieves' hours, dusk till dawn. But Fletcher had found that the best crooks knew how to play off crime as casual. And Fletcher had his sleeves rolled up to the elbows, exposing a variety of marks and scars on his sun-browned forearms. Fletcher's skin was a map of his life. A hard-lived life at that.
"It's true what they say?"
the boy finally asked.
"About what?"
said Fletcher, raising a thick brow.
"About you."
The boy's gaze went to the markings around Fletcher's wrists. The limiters circled both his hands like cuffs, scarred into flesh and something deeper.
"Can I see them?"
"These?"
asked Fletcher, holding up his hands. The markings were a punishment given only to those who defied the golden rule of magic.
"Thou shalt not use thy power to control another," he recited, flashing a cold and crooked grin.
For such a crime, the crown showed little mercy. The guilty were bound, branded with limiters designed to tourniquet their power. But Fletcher's were broken. The marks on the inside of his wrists were marred, obscured, like fractured links in a metal chain. He had gone to the ends of the world to break those binds, had traded blood and soul and years of life. But here he was, free again, of a sort. He was still bound to the shop and the illusion of impotence, an illusion he maintained lest the guards learn of his recovery and return to claim more than his magic. It helped, of course, that he bought favour with a few of them. Everyone, even the rich and the proud and the royal, wanted things they shouldn't have. For those things were Fletcher's specialty. The boy was still staring at the marks, wide-eyed and pale.
"Tack!"
Fletcher brought his arms back to rest on the counter.
"Time for lookings over. You going to buy something or not?"
The boy scurried out empty-handed, and Fletcher sighed and tugged a pipe from his back pocket. He snapped his fingers and a small blue flame danced on the end of his thumb, which he used to light the leaves pressed into the bowl. And then he drew something from his shirt pocket and set it on the wooden counter. It was a chess piece. A small white rook, to be exact. A marker of a debt he'd yet to pay, but would. The rook had once belonged to the young Antari whelp Kel, but it had come to Fletcher's shop several years before as part of the pot in a round of Sankt. Sankt was the kind of game that grew. A mix of strategy and luck and a fair bit of cheating that could be over in minutes or last for hours. And the final hand of the night had been going on for nearly two. They were the last players, Fletcher and Kel, and as the night had grown, so had the pot. They weren't playing for coins, of course. The table was piled high with tokens and trinkets and rare magic. A vial of hope sand, a water blade, a coat that concealed an infinite number of sides. Fletcher had played every card but three, a pair of kings with a saint among them. He was sure he'd won. And then Kel played three saints. The problem was there were only three saints in the whole deck, and Fletcher had one in his hand. But as Kel laid out his hand, the card in Fletcher's shimmered and changed from a saint to a servant, the lowest card in the deck. Fletcher turned red as he watched it. The royal brat had slipped an enchanted card into the set and played Fletcher as well as the game. And that was the best and worst thing about Sankt. Nothing was off limits. You didn't have to win fair. You only had to win. Fletcher had no choice but to lay out his ruined hand, and the room broke into raucous comments and jeers. Kel only smiled and shrugged and got to his feet. He plucked a trinket from the top of the pile, a chess piece from another London, and tossed it to Fletcher.
"No hard feelings,"
he said with a wink before he took the lot and left.
"No hard feelings."
Fletcher's fingers tightened on the small stone statue. The bell at the front of the shop rang as another customer stepped in. A tall, thin man with a graying beard and a hungry glint in his eye. Fletcher pocketed the rook and managed a grim smile.
"Erasa es ferasa."
Coming or going? 3. Kel could feel the stone in Lila's pocket as they walked. There had been a moment when his fingers closed over hers and his skin had brushed the talisman when all he wanted was to take it from her. It felt like everything would be all right if he could simply hold it, which was an absurd notion. Nothing would be all right so long as the stone existed. Still, it pulled at his senses, and he shivered and tried not to think about it as he led Lila through Red London away from the noise and toward the ruby fields. Rye's celebration would last all day, drawing the majority of the city, its people and its guard, to the banks of the river and the Red Palace. Guilt rolled through him. He should have been a part of the procession, should have ridden in the open carriage with the royal family, should have been there to tease and chide his brother for the way he relished the attention. Kel was sure that Rye would sulk for weeks about his absence. And then he remembered that he'd never have the chance to apologize. The thought cut like a knife, even though he told himself it had to be this way, that when the time came, Lila would explain. And Rye would forgive him. Kel kept his collar up and his head down, but he still felt eyes on him as they moved through the streets. He kept looking over his shoulder, unable to shake the feeling of being followed. Which he was, of course, by Lila, who looked at him with increasing scrutiny as they wove through the streets. Something was clearly bothering her, but she held her tongue, and for a while Kel wondered if she was biding his order or simply biding her time. And then, when the appearance of a pair of royal guards, helmets tucked casually under their arms, sent Kel and, by necessity, Lila retreating hastily into a recessed doorway, she finally broke her silence.
"Tell me something, Kel,"
she said as they stepped back onto the curb when the men were gone.
"The commoners treat you like a noble, yet you hide from the guards like a thief. Which is it?"
"Neither," he answered, silently willing her to let the matter go. But Lila wouldn't.
"Are you some kind of valiant criminal?" she pressed. "A Robin Hood? All hero to the people and outlaw to the crown?"
"No."
"Are you wanted for something?"
"Not exactly."
"In my experience," observed Lila, "a person is either wanted or they're not. Why would you hide from the guards if you're not?"
"Because I thought they might be looking for me."
"And why would they be doing that?"
"Because I'm missing." He heard Lila's steps slow.
"Why would they care?"
she asked, coming to a stop.
"Who are you?"
Kel turned to face her. "I told you."
"No,"
she said, eyes narrowing.
"Who are you here? Who are you to them?"
Kel hesitated. All he wanted was to cross through his city as quickly as possible, retrieve a white London token from his rooms, and get the wretched Blackstone out of this world. But Lila didn't look like she planned on moving until he answered her. "I belong to the royal family," he said. In the matter of hours he'd known Lila, he'd learned that she didn't surprise easily. But at this claim, her eyes finally went wide with disbelief.
"You're a prince?"
"No," he said firmly.
"Like the pretty fellow in the carriage. Is he your brother?"
"His name is Rye, and no." Kel cringed when he said it. "Well, not exactly."
"So you're the black-eyed prince? I have to admit, I never took you for..."
"I'm not a prince, Lila."
"I suppose I can see it. You are rather arrogant, and..."
"I'm not,
but what's a member of the royal family doing..."
Kel pushed her back against the brick wall of the alley. "I am not a member of the royal family," he snapped. "I belong to them." Lila's forehead crinkled.
"What do you mean?"
"They own me," he said, cringing at the words. "I'm a possession, a trinket. So you see, I grew up in the palace, but it is not my home. I was raised by the royals, but they are not my family, not by blood. I have worth to them, and so they keep me, but that is not the same as belonging." The words burned when he spoke them. He knew he wasn't being fair to the king and queen, who treated him with warmth, if not love, or to Rye, who had always looked on him as a brother. But it was true, wasn't it? As much as it pained him. For all his caring and for theirs, the fact remained he was a weapon, a shield, a tool to be used. He was not a prince. He was not a son.
"You poor thing," said Lila coldly, pushing him away. "What do you want? Pity?
You won't find it from me." Kel clenched his jaw.
"I didn't." "You have a house, if not a home," she spat. "You have people who care for you, if not about you. You may not have everything you want, but I'd wager you have everything you could ever need. And you have the audacity to claim it all forfeit because it is not love."
"I..."
"Love doesn't keep us from freezing to death, Kel," she continued, "or starving, or being knifed for the coins in our pocket. Love doesn't buy us anything, so be glad for what you have and who you have, because you may want for things, but you need for nothing."
She was breathless by the time she finished, her eyes bright and her cheeks flushed. And for the first time, Kel saw Lila. Not as she wanted to be, but as she was. A frightened, albeit clever girl trying desperately to stay alive. One who had likely frozen and starved and fought and almost certainly killed to hold on to some semblance of a life, guarding it like a candle in the harsh wind.
"Say something,"
she challenged. Kel swallowed, clenched his hands into fists at his sides, and looked at her hard. "You're right," he said. The admission left him strangely gutted, and in that moment he just wanted to go home. And it was a home, far more of one than Lila probably had. To let the queen touch his cheek, and the king his shoulder. To swing his arm around Rye's neck and toast to his birthday and listen to him ramble and laugh. It ached how badly he wanted it. But he couldn't. He had made a mistake. He had put them all in danger, and he had to make it right, because it was his duty to protect them, and because he loved them. Lila was still staring, waiting for the catch in his words, but there was none. "You're right," he said again. "I'm sorry. Compared to your life, mine must seem a jewel."
"Don't you dare pity me, magic boy,"
growled Lila, a knife in her hand. And just like that, the scared street rat was gone and the cutthroat was back. Kel smiled thinly. There was no winning these battles with Lila, but he was relieved to see her back in the threatening form. He broke her gaze and looked up at the sky, the red of the isle reflecting off the low clouds. A storm was coming. Rye would sulk at that, too, spiteful of anything that might dampen the splendour of his day. "Come on," said Kel. "We're almost there." Lila sheathed her blade and followed, this time with fewer daggers in her eyes.
"This place we're headed," she said, "does it have a name?"
"Iskirais," said Kel. "The Ruby Fields." He had not told Lila yet that her journey would end here, that it had to, for his peace of mind and for her safety.
"What are you hoping to find there?"
"A token," said Kel. "Something that will grant us passage to White London." He paused through the shelves and drawers in his mind, the various trinkets from the various cities glittering behind his eyes. "The inn itself," he went on, "is run by a woman named Fauna. You two should get along splendidly."
"Why's that?"
"Because you're both..." He was about to say hard as tacks, but then he rounded the corner and came to a sharp stop, the words dying on his tongue.
"Is that the Ruby Fields?"
asked Lila at his shoulder. "It is," said Kel quietly. "Or it was." There was nothing left but ash and smoke. The inn and everything in it had been burned to the ground. 4. It had been no ordinary fire. Ordinary fires didn't consume metal as well as wood. An ordinary fire spread. This one hadn't. It traced the edges of the building and burned in a near-perfect inn-shaped blaze, only a few tendrils scorching the street stones that circled the building. No, this was spell work. And it was fresh. Warmth still wafted off the ruins as Kel and Lila waded through them, searching for something, anything that might have survived. But nothing had. Kel felt sick. This kind of fire burned hot and fast, and the edges suggested a binding circle. It wouldn't simply have contained the flames. It would have contained everything. Everyone. How many people had been trapped inside? How many corpses now in the wreckage, reduced to bone or merely ash? And then Kel thought selfishly of his room. Years of collecting. Music boxes and lockets, instruments and ornaments, the precious and the simple and the strange. All gone. Rye's warning, "Give up this foolishness before you're caught," echoed in his head. And for an instant Kel was glad that he'd been robbed of the bounty before it could be discovered. And then the weight of it sank in. Whoever did this, they hadn't robbed him. At least that hadn't been the point. But they'd stripped him of his loot to cut him off. An Antari could not travel without tokens. They were trying to corner him to make sure that if he managed to flee back into Red London, he would have nothing at his disposal. It was a measure of thoroughness that reeked of Holland's own hand. The same hand that had ripped the London coins from Kell's throat and cast them away into the dark. Lila towed the melted remains of a kettle.
"What now?"
"There's nothing here," said Kel, letting a handful of ash slide through his fingers. "We'll have to find another token." He brushed the soot from his hands, thinking. He wasn't the only person in Red London with a trinket, but the list was short, as he'd been far more willing to trade in artifacts from the novel harmless grey than the warped and violent white. The king himself had a token, passed down over the years. Fauna had one, a trinket as part of their deal, though Fauna, he feared, was now buried somewhere in the rubble. And Fletcher had one. Kell cringed inwardly. "I know a man," he said, which wasn't the half of it, but was certainly simpler than explaining that Fletcher was a petty criminal who'd lost a bounty to him in a game of sunked when Kell was several years younger and several shades more arrogant, and Kell had gifted him the White London trinket as either a peace offering, if he felt like lying to himself, or a jab, if he was being honest. "Fletcher. He keeps a shop by the docks. He'll have a token."
"Yes, well, let's hope they haven't burned his shop down as well."
"I'd like to see them try—" The words died in Kell's throat. Someone was coming. Someone who smelled of dried blood and burning metal. Kell lunged for Lila, and she got out half a word of protest before he clamped one hand over her mouth and shoved the other into her pocket. His fingers found the stone and folded over it, and power surged through his body, coursed through his blood. Kell caught his breath as a shudder ran through him. But there was no time to dwell on the sensation, at once thrilling and terrifying, and no time to hesitate. "Conviction," Holland had said. "Conviction is key." So Kell did not waffle, did not waver.
"Conceal us," he ordered the talisman.
And the stone obliged. It sang to life, its power ringing through him as, between one heartbeat and the next, black smoke enveloped Kell and Lila both. It settled over them like a shadow, a veil. When he brought his fingers to it, they met something that was far more than air and less than cloth. When Kell looked down at Lila, he could see her, and when she looked up, she could clearly see him, and the world around them was still perfectly visible, albeit tinted by the spell. Kell held his breath and hoped the stone had done its task. He didn't have a choice. There was no time to run. Just then Holland appeared at the mouth of the side street. Kell and Lila both tensed at the sight of him. He looked slightly crumpled from his time on the alley floor. His wrists were red and raw beneath his wrinkled half-cloak. His silver clasp was tarnished, his collar flecked with mud, and his expression as close to anger as Kell had ever seen it. A small crease between his brows, a tightness in his jaw. Kell could feel the stone shudder in his hand, and he wondered if Holland was drawn to it, or if it was drawn to Holland. The other Antiri was holding something, a flattened crystal the size and shape of a playing card, up to his lips, and speaking into it in his low, even way.
"Ova Sotaro,"
he said in his native tongue. "He is in the city." Kell couldn't hear the other person's answer, but after a pause, Holland answered,
"Kosa,"
"I'm sure," and slipped the crystal back into his pocket. The Antari tipped his shoulder against the wall and studied the charred ruins of the inn. He stood there as if lost in thought. Or waiting. The steadiness of his gaze made Lila fidget ever so slightly against Kell, and he tightened his grip over her mouth. Holland squinted. Perhaps in thought, perhaps at them. And then he spoke.
"They screamed while the building was burning," he said in English, his voice too loud to be meant only for himself. "All of them screamed by the end. Even the old woman."
Kell gritted his teeth.
"I know you're here, Kell," continued Holland. "Even the burnt remains cannot hide your scent. And even the stone's magic cannot hide the stone. Not from me. It calls to me the way it does to you. I would find you anywhere, so end this foolishness and face me."
Kell and Lila stood frozen in front of him, only a few short strides separating them.
I'm in no mood for games, warned Holland,
his usual calm now flecked by annoyance. When neither Kel nor Lila moved, he sighed and drew a silver pocket watch from his cloak. Kel recognized it as the one Lila had left behind for Baron. He felt her stiffen against him as Holland tossed the timepiece in their direction. It bounced along the blackened street, skidding to a stop at the edge of the inn's charred remains. From here, Kel could see that it was stained with blood.
"He died because of you," said Holland, addressing Lila. "Because you ran. You were a coward."
"Are you still?"
Lila struggled to get free of Kel's arms, but he held her there with all his strength, pinning her against his chest. He felt tears slide over his hand at her mouth, but he didn't let go.
"No,"
he said breathlessly into her ear.
"Not here. Not like this."
Holland sighed.
"You will die a coward's death, Delilah Bard."
He drew a curved blade from beneath his cloak.
"When this is over," he said, "you will both wish you had come out."
He lifted his empty hand, and a wind caught up the ashes of the ruined inn, whipping them into the air overhead. Kel looked up at the cloud of it over them and said a prayer under his breath.
"Last chance," said Holland.
When he was met by silence, he lowered his hand and the ash began to fall. And Kel saw what would happen. It would drift down and settle on the veil, exposing them, and Holland would be upon them both in an instant. Kel's mind spun as his grip tightened on the stone, and he was about to summon its power again when the ash met their veil and passed through. It sank straight through the impossible cloth, and then through them as though they were not there, as though they were not real. The crease between Holland's two-toned eyes deepened as the last of the ash settled back to the ruins. And Kel took a very small measure of comfort from the Antari's frustration. He may be able to sense them, but he could not see them. Finally, when the wind was gone and the ground lay still, and Kel and Lila remained concealed by the power of the stone, Holland's certainty faltered. He sheathed the curved blade and took a step back, turned, and strode away, cloak billowing behind him. The moment he was gone, Kel's grip on Lila loosened, and she wrenched free of him and the spell and shot forward to the silver watch on the street.
"Lila!" he called.
She didn't seem to hear him, and he didn't know if it was because she'd abandoned their protective shroud or because her world had narrowed to the size and shape of a small, blooded watch. He watched her sink to one knee and take up the timepiece with shaking fingers. He went to Lila's side and brought his hand to her shoulder, or tried, but it went straight through. So, he was right. The veil didn't simply make them invisible. It made them incorporeal.
"Reveal me," he ordered the stone.
Energy rippled through him, and a moment later the veil dissolved. Kel marveled a moment at how easy it had been as he knelt beside her. The magic had come effortlessly, but this was the first time it had willingly undone itself. They could not afford to stay there, exposed. So Kel took her arm and silently summoned the magic to conceal them once more. It obeyed, the shadow veil settling again over them both. Lila shook under his touch, and he wanted to tell her it was all right, that Holland might have taken the timepiece and left Baron's life. But he did not want to lie. Holland was many things, most of them well hidden, but he was not sentimental. If he had ever been compassionate, or at least merciful, Athos had bled it out of him long ago, carved it out along with his soul. No, Holland was ruthless, and Baron was dead. "Lila," said Kel gently, "I'm sorry." Her fingers curled tightly round the timepiece as she rose to her feet. Kel rose with her, and even though she would not look him in the eye, he could see the anger and pain written in the lines of her face.
"When this is over," she said, tucking the watch into a fold of her cloak, "I want to be the one to slit his throat."
And then she straightened and let out a small, shuddering breath. "Now," she said, "which way to Fletcher?"
10. One White Rook. 1.
Booth,